open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
What is really frightening for most of us is how ordinary murderers are. They look like you and me, and they look like Uncle Michael, who helped me with my homework.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. On today's program, mystery novelist Tess Gerritsen. When she was young, Gerritsen had an experience that defined her writing. A neighbor she was close to was arrested for murdering his sister-in-law.
And to this day, I still think, you know, I never saw that. This was a part of him I never realized was there. And I think that crime writing for me is about trying to understand who the real person is behind the smiling mask. And really, that's what mystery novels are all about. Who is really behind that mask?
Tess Gerritsen is best known for her series of books featuring police detective Jane Rizzoli and medical examiner Maura Iles, which inspired the TV series Rizzoli and Iles. She talks this hour with Traverse City teacher and Front Street Writers Workshop leader Carrie Woofter. Gerritsen starts off explaining how she became a writer.
I knew I wanted to be a writer since I was 7 years old, which seems to be a universal age for a lot of writers to self-identify. But I am the child of Chinese immigrants, and Asian immigrants are really focused on security for their children. And my dad said, writing is not a way to make a living. So he convinced me to go into science, and that explains why there are so many Chinese doctors and engineers and computer scientists. It's our parents all told us the same thing. I went to medical school. I became an internal medicine doctor, but on maternity leave, I decided I was going to write my first book, and I really haven't gone back.
You mentioned in an interview that I watched that you did two practice novels before your first novel was picked up for publication. Did you know there were practice novels when you were writing them?
Or? Oh, no, I thought they were great literature.
Did you?
I mean, every time you write a book, you write the best book you are capable of at the time. And if I were to go back and look at those, I would probably cringe.
Have you not looked at them?
No, I don't even know where they are. They disappeared somewhere.
That might be really fun. Or terrifying, one or the other. You have a bent towards the gruesome. The medical thriller really lends itself to that, obviously. And a lot of your books are frightening. I'm listening to a book right now. I was telling Tess at lunch, I've started 3 or 4 times and I had to stop because it was a little bit overwhelming. And I'm wondering, but we were also talking about the fact that there's never any violence on the page in your books. What from your childhood lent to your fascination with kind of the horror genre or the frightening, but has led you away from that violent
aspect?
Well,
there were two things. One was that my mother, an immigrant, didn't understand English very well. But what she did understand, what she did love, was the American horror film. It's very visual, so you don't really need to understand the language. Mm-hmm. She dragged my brother and me to every scary movie that Hollywood ever made. This was before the era of PG ratings. So we sat and screamed our way through our childhood in movie theaters. And I learned that was sort of the epitome of entertainment, was to frighten your audience. I also learned a lot of sort of storytelling rules from Hollywood. If there's a rock and you turn it over, something weird is going to crawl out. If the door is locked, don't open it. There's something bad behind it. But there's something else that, you know, that I haven't told you about, and that was I was exposed, in a sense, to a homicide when I was a child. This is not so funny. I had a beloved family friend named, I'll just call him Uncle Michael. He was about 6 years older than me. He and his mother was a really good friend of my mom, so they would come over to visit, and Michael and I spent a lot of time together. He was a gentle soul. He taught me how to sew. He helped me with my homework. He was like a father figure because my dad was always working. And I completely trusted him. And when I turned 18, he was arrested for murdering his sister-in-law. He tortured her. He drowned her in the toilet and went to prison. And to this day, I still think, you know, I never saw that. This was a part of him I never realized was there. And I think that crime writing for me is about trying to understand who the real person is behind the smiling mask. And really, that's what mystery novels are all about. Who is really behind that mask?
That's interesting because one of the things that you notice a lot in your novels is that your heroines and heroes and your bad guys and gals are the least likely suspects. They seem kind of like the average Joe or Jane, no pun intended. Do you do that intentionally? Do you think that comes from that experience?
Well, I think that I'm just trying to understand human nature. I mean, I don't understand why you would ever kill another human being unless you're trying to protect their kids. So murder to me is one of these things where it's like a foreign, like an alien has done this. And I want to understand what makes that alien tick. And what is really frightening for most of us is how ordinary murderers are. You know, they look like you and me, and they look like Uncle Michael, who helped me with my homework. So I think that it's going to be a lifelong quest for trying to understand who people really are. Yeah.
You were saying some interesting things about violence and the reasons that you don't feel like you need to have the violence on the page. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's strangely enough, even though I write sort of gory fiction, I don't like to see it on the page, happen on the page. I don't like to watch it on screen. The way I approach mystery is that the act happens, and it's a horrific act. But what you see is the point of view of the investigators who walk in afterwards, and they're looking at the blood splatters, they're looking at the body, and they're trying to reenact in their own minds what happened in this room. And it's the reenactment in their own minds which may strike some readers as being the violent act, but it doesn't appear on the pages. I feel that that's enough of a distance between the reader and the crime to make it feel more palatable, if such a thing is palatable. But it also helps me put some distance between me and the violence as well.
I think it's a testimony to your skill as a writer that your reader, I think most of the time, I would think in quick review, yes, that murder happened. I saw that, I read that scene. But then when I went back and looked at the stories I had or read of yours this afternoon after we talked about that, I realized none of those things actually happened. It was in the recreation and it was so real. Yeah. In the investigator's recreation that it became real for me.
Yeah, because it's told from the point of view of professionals. And you know, I've been in the operating room when somebody bled to death, and it's a horrifying thing. You know, the blood is going all over the place. But in that situation, you weren't there to be horrified. You're there to do a job. And you're there with your arms, you know, elbow deep in blood, saying, "Where's the bleeder? Where's the bleeder?" And you don't have time to be horrified. You're just there to do your job. And I think that's what Jane and Maura do when they walk into a room like that.
You started out in medicine. You were actually a practicing physician. You started writing, and you were writing romance novels. What was the transition like from romance? How did you make that leap from romance to medical thriller, which has a lot in common?
Well, I started doing romance because one of my patients gave me a bag of romance novels when I was practicing. And she was leaving the hospital, and she said, "You might enjoy these." So I was working 80 hours a week as an intern, and I read every darn novel in that bag. And I began to think there's a lot of comfort to romance fiction. You know, at the end of a day, hard work in the hospital, maybe you've seen somebody die, you pick up a romance novel, you know it's going to be a happy ending. So I loved those books, and when I first started writing, I started off in the romance genre, but they were romantic suspense, and they always had murder in them. I mean, really, romance and murder, I mean, it goes together. But my first book that got sold was to Harlequin Intrigue, and I remember my editor calling me up after she accepted it, and she said, "Do you remember how many people you killed in this book?" I said, "No." And she said, "Well, we had an editorial meeting and we counted 13 murders. She said, "This is a record for Harlequin." But they published the book anyway. I should have gotten the hint then that I was meant to be a thriller writer.
And how many years did it take? Was there about 10 years in between?
I wrote 9 romantic suspense novels, and then I got the idea for Harvest, and that was my first big thriller.
In both the romance genre and mystery genre, one of the things that we see when authors are here is that those seem to be two genres where the writers have to produce relatively quickly, and you're very prolific. What do you do to maintain that pace where you have a new book coming out every 2 years, 18 months?
You know, I'm not that prolific, actually, when you compare it to somebody like Debbie Macomber.
Yeah.
I write, if I'm, you know, on my track, I'll write a book about a year, every year. I think it gets harder as your life gets fuller of other things that are happening. You know, now I think how many years do I have left where I'm mobile? I want to be able to travel and spend time with my family. So I am slowing down a bit, but what keeps me going is the contracts.
Yeah.
You know, you will deliver a book on such and such a date. I'm very good. I just don't deliver late.
You stick to your deadlines.
I stick to my deadlines, yeah.
Do you write every day? Do you have a place or a time? Is there any writing ritual for you?
I have an over my garage, which and my window looks out over the ocean. So it's a very distracting view. But I think that the one thing I do that's unusual for most writers is my first drafts are always with pen and paper.
Oh.
I can type 100 words a minute. That's not the problem. The problem is if I see the words on the computer screen, I want to edit it to death. And so I will edit that first paragraph again and again and never get past the paragraph. But my writing, I'm a doctor, is so bad. My handwriting is so bad that I can't necessarily see the errors on the page. So
right.
I will write with it's pen and unlined typing paper.
So
I don't like
the
lines.
Does that free you up that you're not editing yourself as you go? You can
right.
get it all out there?
And that's something I tell my writing students very often is mm-hmm. don't edit yourself too much because it will stop your forward progress. You'll see the flaws in it. It's important to get through the first draft first, and then you'll know what the book is about.
That's really interesting. You mentioned earlier, too, that you don't do the outline and the character sketches beforehand.
No, I'm very organic in that way. I mean, I start off, here's how almost all of my best books started off is I got freaked out by something. Something scared me, a very strong emotion, and I just thought, oh my God, where would this story go
mm-hmm.
next? The example I always use is Vanish because it was started with one newspaper article. I read an article in the Boston Globe about a young woman who was found dead in her bathtub. Mm-hmm. They found empty pill bottles by her side, so they thought, it's just an accidental overdose.
Mm-hmm.
They zipped her into a body bag, sent her off to the morgue, and a couple of hours later, she woke up in the body bag. And she went home perfectly fine. But it's one of those things where you read that and think, this is the beginning of a book. What
yeah.
happens next? So I start off with some incredible idea like that, and then I want to see what happens next. And in that particular case, she woke up in the morgue where Maura Iles was working late mm-hmm. one night. Maura sends her off to the emergency room, and in the hospital, the dead woman does something nobody expects. She grabs a security guard's gun, she kills him, and she takes hostages in the hospital. And among the hostages she takes is a very pregnant homicide detective named Jane Rizzoli, who's come to have her baby, and she's in active labor and a hostage. So it's one of these things where you start off with something that just grabs you and you just mm-hmm. get the ball rolling and see what happens and add up the complications and the conflicts and eventually you figure out what it's all about.
Do you have a plan? Do you know what the next two or three books are, particularly with the Rizzoli and Iles, because you mentioned that's your contract is Rizzoli and Iles.
Right.
So do you know what?
No, I have no idea. I don't ask me who Maura's going to end up with because I don't know yet.
I think I know.
so even from the very first Rizzoli and Iles book, which was The Surgeon, mm-hmm. there was a major change in my idea as the book was being written. The Surgeon is, I should tell you where that book came from because it's sort of a funny story.
That's a creepy one.
it's a really creepy book. It's about a serial killer who does something really horrible to his victims before he kills them. He operates on them while they're still awake and aware. That book came about because I was on book tour for Gravity about the space program.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the shops, a woman reader stood up and she looked perfectly normal. She said, I'm not interested in space. I want you to write about something I am interested in. I said, what's that? And she said, serial killers and twisted sex.
Good.
So I had to ask, what do you do for a living? I just want to know.
Well, she wasn't a teacher, a librarian, was she?
She said, I teach.
Of course.
And I said, what do you teach? And she said, the third grade. So I went home thinking, okay, third grade teachers have an active fantasy life I didn't know about. And I'll write a book about serial killers and twisted sex. And the other part about that, which I asked some of my readers, do you like these books? And my women readers said something fascinating. They said, we love serial killer books, but only if the victims are women. I said, what about
really?
If they're men? And they said, oh, we don't care about those. So What does this mean? Are we masochistic? Because it's true for me, if I pick up a scary book, I want to read about women victims. And I came to the conclusion that, you know, because children like scary books for children are potential victims, mm-hmm. that women and kids, we feel vulnerable in society, so the person we identify with in these scary books is the victim. So I wrote a book about serial killers, twisted sex, and female victims, and that was The Surgeon. And I introduced a character named Detective Jane Rizzoli. We're still on the subject of how I don't plan things out. So Jane Rizzoli walks onto the page, and she's immediately annoying. Nobody likes Jane. She's sort of bitchy. And I thought, I don't really need to make her likable, because I'm going to kill her. I had every plan. As soon as she walked on, I thought, she's annoying. I'll kill her before the end of the book. But as I'm writing this book, and I'm getting to know who Jane is, and I realize she's a smart chick. She works hard. She has a reason to be bitter and angry. And when it came time to kill her, I couldn't do it. I couldn't. So that's one of those things where somewhere in the middle of the book, everything changes, and it takes on a different shape than you ever imagined.
How many Rizzoli and Isle books had you written before TNT picked up the characters?
I think it might have been about book 4 or 5 when I got the call.
What did that process look like?
I got a call from a TV producer named Bill Haber, and he said, I've been reading your books, I love your girls, and I think they belong on TV. And I've sold almost all my books to Hollywood, but nothing ever happens. Mm-hmm. So I thought, it's gonna fall apart. My philosophy is cash the check, walk away, forget about it. And his check cleared, that's all I cared about. And I forgot about it. And a year later, he called me up and he said, "We have a great TV script, and we just need to, you know, cast the part of Jane Rizzoli first." Well, if you haven't read The Surgeon, Jane Rizzoli is not an attractive girl. She's really frumpy. She has like messy hair. She dresses like a tomboy. The men mm-hmm. ignore her because she's not good looking. And when he called back and he said, "We have Jane Rizzoli, and it's Angie Harmon," I thought. Okay, well, she's no longer ugly. She's gorgeous. And then they cast the part of Maura Isles with some screen testing against Angie. And mm-hmm. Sasha Alexander had the best on-screen chemistry, and that's how I ended up with two glamorous women playing my two ordinary characters.
It's interesting. You mentioned that once you sold the rights, you haven't had creative control over the two of them.
No.
And they have evolved different mm-hmm. Path in your book. I find it very fascinating that Rizzoli has the same sensibility on the screen as she seems to in your book, but Maura seems very different to me. Do you have that same impression?
Yeah, I think the writers, and this, you know, it started off with an executive producer named Janet Tamaro, who was mm-hmm. very insightful about things, and she said, I remember the first time we met, she said, "I know who you were really writing about, Jane and Maura." And I said, "What?" And she goes, "They're Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock."
Did you know that's what you were really writing about?
I didn't know that, but after she said that, I thought, you know, she has a point. So I think they played that up, you know, where Jane Rizzoli is that, you know, forceful Captain Kirk, and Maura Isles is the logical, scientific Mr. Spock, except that their Maura Isles loves shoes.
Yes. She is quite a fashionista.
Yes, she's a fashionista.
Do you find that the portrayal of the characters on the screen affects your writing of them at all?
I try not to let it, because I want to stick to my characters the way I created them. And also, a lot of my readers will never watch the television show, so I can't really make drastic changes.
Yeah. Grow 6 inches.
Right. The one thing the show did very, very well from the very beginning was emphasize the friendship mm-hmm. between two female professionals. And I remember the producer said that's what he was looking for. There hadn't been anything like that since Cagney and Lacey, unless you want to include Xena and Gabrielle. So they were looking for something about strong female friendship. And I said, "What about the men?" And he said, "Oh, there will be no marriages on this TV show because men just screw things up."
This is true.
And this is a guy talking. So he decided that it was going to be focused immediately on the friendship, and from the very first episode you could see that they were already friends. In the books it's been a slower build, and I think they truly became friends about book 4.
Right, it is much slower progression.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is always a twist or series of twists in your books, and as my husband knows, am constantly trying to guess. Every movie I try to ruin because I think I know the twist. And I'm right a lot, but I am never right with your books. And I love that because they're always fresh and I don't know how they're going to end and I'm taken by surprise. Do you know what those twists are going to be when you start the book?
No. I usually figure it out about halfway to two-thirds of the way through the story.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to Vanish again, because I've already sort of told you where it came mm-hmm. from and where it goes. When I first started writing that first draft of Vanish, it was a man in the body bag, and the man who takes hostages, and the man who threatens Jane Rizzoli. And about halfway through, I thought, I don't know why he's doing any of these things. I don't know what his motive is.
Right.
And even worse, I was bored with the story. So how do I handle that? I get writer's block with every single book I've written because I don't know what happens next.
Okay.
I went on a long drive, and I find that a lot of writers tell me this, that long drives sort of get the creative juices going because you're semi-focused on the road, but your mind is still working. And on that drive, I realized what my problem was. It was a man who had taken hostages. And when you think about who takes hostages in this world, it's usually men. It's a very sort of like everyday thing almost. And that was why I was bored, because it didn't seem special.
Gotcha.
And I thought, what if it was a woman who took hostages? Then it's weird. Then you've got to ask yourself, what is really going on? And I went home, and I just kept writing it from that point on as if it had always been a woman in the body bag. I didn't bother to go back and edit. I just wanted to see what happened. So if you look at my first drafts, you'd be very confused. about halfway through, this character undergoes a sex change, right? But that's how I figure things out. You know, somewhere along the way, I get stuck. I don't know where the plot goes, and then you just have to wait for that aha moment to finally get you.
How do you maintain those aha moments? What do you do to prime your imagination to keep it?
I do the same things that classically work. Hot water, and this goes back to Archimedes. He's in a bathtub, and he went eureka. And I think a lot of us get ideas in the shower or in the bath. I find again, you know, driving, transportation where I don't really have to, you know, it's not bad traffic. It's just like a highway driving. And I also find that long walks help. So writer's block. It's really your subconscious telling you the story has reached a dead end. You need to find something fresh and new to recharge it.
I don't want to talk too much about Die Again just yet, but I'm curious what the fodder was for Die Again. Tell us just a tiny bit about it, because I know there's a lot of people that will buy your book tonight.
Okay.
And I don't want to give away the end.
Well, yeah.
But we know right away that there's two sides. There's the story that's taking place in Africa on the safari, and then there is the crime that's being solved in Boston. So where did that?
Like every book that I really have fun time with, it was something that scared me. My husband and I went on safari a couple of years ago, and if you ever go on safari, you know, you land in the bush somewhere, and somebody comes to pick you up in a Jeep, and he gives you instructions. He says, stay in the Jeep. Don't get out of the Jeep unless I tell you it's okay. Do everything I say because I'm here to keep you alive. And it's really weird that staying in the Jeep is keeps you safe because there's no roofs on these mm-hmm. Jeeps. I mean, the animals could jump in and eat you at any time.
Yeah.
But for some reason, if you're in this vehicle, they consider you one big animal. So we had a lovely time there. And then at sunset, we would always find a clearing to have cocktails. And he found this beautiful clearing on the top of a hill. And we all got out of the Jeep, and we're all sitting there drinking our gin and tonic. And my husband said, I have to pee. I'm going to go in that bush over there. And our guide said, why don't you go in the other direction? Because I heard some radio chatter that somebody had seen a leopard in the valley over there. So he crosses to the other side, uses a bush over there, and 30 seconds later, out of the bush he was originally going towards, a leopard walked out. We were all out of the Jeep with our cocktails.
And looking very dangerous and intimidating, I'm sure.
Looking like, what do we do now? And the leopard walked toward us. And our guide just said, everybody, freeze. And he moved between us and the leopard. He stood there with his arms out, and he stared that cat down. And the cat turned around and walked back into the bushes. And then we got in the Jeep. But what I learned from that is that you really have to trust your guide. You have to do what he says. He saved our lives, and he certainly saved my husband's life. And my husband hates it when I say this, but I said, He saved my husband from the ignominious death with his fly open. So I, after that, I, you know, the thriller writer takes over, you know, and then I'm thinking, wow, what if we're out there and we trusted the wrong person? What if the most dangerous creature in the African bush walks on two legs?
It was such a fun, I loved how it was alternating chapters. I kept having to keep myself from skipping ahead to try to figure out who was doing what in the bush, because I knew that would make the whole Boston situation unravel for myself, but it was really hard this time. Maura and Jane are so different from each other, and you seem to use them, and I wonder if you do this intentionally, to hit on a couple major themes. One of the things that I see reoccurring is the idea of justice. Maura seems to be very black and white. Jane is more of a, you know,
she's flexible.
The means justify, you know, the ends justify the means.
Yeah.
Is that intentional on your part? Is that something that you're thinking about as you're writing?
It has to do with a number of cops I've met, and you know, their sense of justice is flexible.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to one Boston PD cop who said he arrested somebody he didn't particularly like, and the guy was talking back to him, so he drove him to the station in the trunk.
Yep.
He threw him in the trunk, shut the trunk and drove there, and I thought, well, that's police brutality, but he said it was justified. But, you know, it's yeah, that sort of a thing, so I can understand Jane's point of view. I also, you know, I've talked to a number of pathologists who, for them, science is everything. The logic, you know, what they conclude is how they're going to testify, and I know there was one case in Florida of a police brutality case where the ME had to come in on the case, and he declared it a homicide.
Mm-hmm.
The police would not talk to him after that. They turned their backs on him. They had this line, and the pathologist had crossed it by telling the truth. So that's the psychology I'm working with Jane. You know, you don't rat out your fellow officers.
Mm-hmm.
Maura, again, she's like a doctor, a logical doctor. She tells the truth.
Right.
Yeah.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, Tess Gerritsen talks about her book Gravity and her new novel, Die Again.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. The National Writer Series is a year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. We return now to Carrie Woofter's conversation with novelist Tess Gerritsen.
Speaking of justice, we were talking about your book, Gravity. Tess wrote Gravity in 1999, am I right? It was published in 1999. Can you tell us about that whole situation? It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I wrote a book called Gravity. It's basically about a female medical doctor astronaut from NASA who gets trapped aboard the International Space Station after the rest of her crew dies in a series of accidents.
Mm-hmm.
It was sold to New Line Productions, which is now a division of Warner Brothers. And at the time it was in development, they got a script, and they were not quite happy with the third act, so I rewrote the third act for them,
mm-hmm.
Which included scenes of satellite debris destroying ISS and the female astronaut left drifting in her spacesuit.
Hmm.
That movie never got made.
Mm-hmm.
And then a number of years later, Alfonso Cuarón wrote and directed his original script called Gravity. It came out in 2013,
mm-hmm.
and I saw the movie and I thought, well, there are a lot of similarities here. And my readers kept writing me saying, congratulations on your movie. And all I could say was, from what I've been told, it's not based on my book.
Right.
And then in February of last year, my literary agent got a call from a whistleblower who had been working in the production company when my book was in development and said, this has been that this person was being bothered. The conscience was you know, bugging this person, and wanted to reveal that at the time my book was in development for Hollywood, they had attached a director, and the director was Alfonso Cuarón. So at that point, I thought it's no longer a coincidence.
Right.
Yeah. So that's why we are in the middle of seeking justice now. We filed suit in April, and we're waiting for the court to decide on a motion to dismiss.
And you're learning a lot about.
I'm learning a lot. Well, what I mainly learned from the beginning is the difference between copyright infringement and breach of contract, mm-hmm. Because the movie was made by Warner Brothers, and the script, my book. Was signed over to a division of Warner Brothers. They own the rights. They had every right to make the movie, but they should have obeyed the contract.
Right.
So it's really a breach of contract case.
That's interesting. And there's probably no projection on when that will be resolved.
Could be after I die. I have no idea. I mean, the way justice works. But
right.
It's because of this lawsuit. I mean, I'm hearing from a lot of screenwriters who have said, you know, this happens all the time.
Yeah. So Die Again, you mentioned the safari. Was your guide, obviously you used the name, Greg Posthumus was
yeah.
Their guide on safari, and Johnny Posthumus is the guide in the book. Were there any other things from your safari that you used, people that you used?
It was mostly stuff that our guide, who's really named mm-hmm. Posthumus, would tell us. I mean, little things he would say, like if you run into a lion or you know a carnivore, face them head on, because that's how they differentiate between prey animals and predatory animals. Those who are predators have their eyes forward facing,
mm-hmm.
and prey animals have their eyes more on the sides of their head to, you know, for a greater range of view. And sometimes that'll be enough to stop a lion attack, because they see, oh my gosh, this is a fellow predator.
Right.
The other thing I found out, which was so fascinating, was leopard behavior. I mean, I did a lot of my research mm-hmm. about leopards. Leopards, when they kill their prey, they drag it up into a tree, and they leave it up there to keep it away from scavengers. They want the meat for themselves. So they'll feed, and then they'll leave for a while, and they'll come back, and they'll eat some more until mm-hmm. until the meat's all gone. If you're in the bush and you see a zebra in a tree, you know how it got there.
Okay.
There's only one
animal. There's a leopard around.
There's only one animal that would have done that. Other things that were interesting about leopards, they're very solitary. But they may have had something to do with helping us evolutionarily as a species. In ancient Africa, before we were truly evolved, I mean, protein was really important. And ancient man must have realized that zebra in the tree was fast food.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't have to chase the zebra. So they would wait for the leopard to go away, and they'd steal the meat. It was McDonald's in the bush.
Right.
And I read one theory that extra protein may have helped us evolve a little more quickly.
Oh, that's interesting.
And the other thing that came into the book was a lot of research about cats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I love cats. I mean, I've been accused of hating cats by people who read this book. But I grew up with cats. And I have come to the conclusion that cats have truly not been domesticated. That they've domesticated
yes.
us to serve them.
That's happened in my house,
yeah,
for sure.
We are the can openers. And cats... cats have, I mean, unlike dogs, dogs are truly domesticated. They live to serve us, but not that same way with cats. The other thing about cats is they have a disease that is really fascinating. It's toxoplasmosis. And you pick it up by, you know, handling the litter box. And,
that's why I
and
make picking, my husband do.
Right. Picking, and if you get infected, it can cause, you know, cysts in your brain. And what that does is it has a wide range of behavioral changes in human beings. It can turn people schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. It can make people bipolar. It can lead to general clumsiness so that you're more accident prone. What it means is that the old myth of the crazy cat lady has a biological basis for it. So if you have multiple cats, you're probably being exposed to toxo all the time. I saw some estimate that 50 million Americans show evidence that they have been exposed to toxoplasmosis. What's really fascinating about toxo, though, is why did the cats evolve this? I mean, how does it serve the cats?
Uh-huh.
Well, if a rat or a mouse gets infected with toxo through the soil, it makes them insanely attracted to the scent of cat urine.
Oh.
So rats and mice will go right towards their predator. And I mean, it just helps the cat. It's, cats are the masters of the universe.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah. I did not know my cat had that much power. That makes me worried. Tell me about the research process that goes into your books.
It really depends on the book. The book I like to use for my research, when I talk about research, is Gravity, because that was the one that really was most out of my sphere of knowledge. I usually start off, and that book took about 6 months of pure research, no writing. Mm-hmm. I start off my research with a lot of reading, and luckily this was pre-9/11, so the shuttle manual, the ISS manual were all online on the NASA website. They're gone now. So I started off reading that, and I also I try to bone up on the culture of whoever I'm going to be talking to. I was an anthropology major in college, so I found that really important. But when it gets time to the nitty-gritty, you have to talk to people who know. And my issue was, I knew it was going to be about a disaster aboard ISS. How do I find out enough about ISS to know how to, you know, plausibly make a disaster happen? Mm-hmm. I had to talk to NASA. So I called up Johnson Space Center, their public affairs officer, otherwise known in NASA speak as the PAO. NASA is also known as the National Acronym Slinging Agency. I called the PAO and I said, I'm writing a book about a biological disaster aboard the International Space Station. Can you help me? And he said, tell me about your book. And I said, well, it's everybody on board dies except for my heroine. And he said, you know what the purpose of my office is here? It is to make my organization look good. So tell me what else goes wrong in your story. And I said, well, an orbiter crashes on landing, killing everybody aboard. And he said, I don't think we want to cooperate. And I said, wait, everything that goes wrong in my story is not your fault. NASA does everything right. And he said, well, whose fault is it? And I said, it's the military's.
And they were like, yes.
And he said, when would you like to come? So this is where anthropology helped me, is that I before I even called, I understood that there's this inherent tension between militarized space and civilian space. Civilian NASA, they grew up on Star Trek. They believe that space is for all of mankind. Mm-hmm. Military space believes, the military believes that that's for our killer satellites. So I get, and the first thing, you do notice that when you pull into the NASA parking lot, all the Beam Me Up Scotty bumper stickers. They did grow up on Star Trek. So I'm there, and when I do my research, it's not just to find out, you know, like the nitty-gritty of what the carpet looks like in the press room. I'm there to find out things that freak me out, things that bother me, because those are the things that my audience would like to know about, the inside things that they don't want to tell you. I remember asking the PAO, what are the chances of a disaster in space? And he said, well, we'd tell the public 1 out of 1,000. And of course, I heard that preface, yeah. We tell the public. And I said, well, what is it really? And he said, we've done the calculations. We know how often systems fail. 1 out of 50 launches the missions will go badly wrong. And this is before Columbia went down. Ooh. When Columbia went down, he was right on the money, 1 out of 50 launches. So it really raises your respect for these astronauts. Yeah. They know this. They know that when they're strapped into their launch pad and they're about to blast off, that the news agencies have already written their obituaries. As soon as they name people to a mission, Associated Press gets to work writing their obituary because they don't want to hunt for this when things
right.
happen. It also probably wasn't very comforting to know that in Florida when they would launch, there's a concrete bunker there staffed by Air Force range safety officers. And their job is, if the shuttle takes off over a populated area, if something goes wrong mm-hmm. and instead of going over water, they go over a populated area, they blow up the shuttle with everybody okay. aboard. To protect the public. Astronauts know this. So it makes you think they are truly brave people.
Really?
I used to want to be an astronaut when I was a kid. No.
And I
knew Sally Ride at Stanford. So I mean she was like one of our role models, and I thought, wow, what a cool job. And then after doing this research,
not gonna happen.
Not gonna happen.
Do you obsess about the details? Do you go and find all the particulars, or do you just assume my audience does not really know what that looks like?
Well,
or feels
in that
like, or...
in that particular book, I had a goal. Mm-hmm. My goal was to write a book that no NASA engineer would find anything wrong with, and that was incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. Because just starting off, until you know what can go wrong on a spacecraft, you know how things should go right. So I recall sitting with the flight director there of the shuttle program and saying, I need to make a shuttle crash. And I need to have it crash in such a way that the bodies are still fairly intact, because I think I have an autopsy scene after that. And he just looked at me like I was crazy. He said, you know, as far as we know, everything has, you know, we have backup systems for backup systems. I can't tell you how to make a shuttle crash, because everything that could go wrong, we thought of already. And so I said, well, let's approach it a different way. What if your crew goes unconscious? Can you land that shuttle using your computers in Houston? And I just assumed yes, because everything is computerized. Right. And he said, no. He said that you need a human hand to flip three switches starting from orbit. One to start the deorbit burn, to get it, you know, out of orbit. The second is, as the ship is coming in the atmosphere, to launch air data probes that to help the shuttle line up on the runway. And then you need a hand to flip the switch to lower the landing gear. And I said, you just answered my question. Because in the book, my crew goes unconscious between the second and the third switch. So it's all lined up, ready to come in the landing, and then nobody lowers the landing gear. Orbiter crashes. Bodies are not so badly damaged. I can get my autopsy scene. and it's those little things that you really need to get. You need to pick somebody's brain for that, because you can't find that anywhere. And a couple of months after the book came out, I got a call from somebody who worked at Johnson Space Center. He called and he said, I read your book, I'm an engineer here, and you got something wrong. I hate those calls. And I said, well, what did I get wrong? And he said, well, you have your hero drive into the building 30 parking lot and park his car. I said, yeah. And he goes, I've worked here 20 years. I've never found an empty space in that lot.
That's your biggest mistake. You did a good job.
So, you know, he called to say how accurate he thought the book really was. But, you know, that every moment of writing that book, I was terrified that I was out of my depth. And it was like jumping off a cliff with no net. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why that's the book, it's my favorite.
I was sharing with you that I've heard that a few times this week, as people knew I was going to be able to talk to you, that I loved Gravity.
And yet Gravity sold the fewest copies of any book I've written.
That's so interesting.
You know, my favorite books are Gravity and The Bone Garden. And
Bone Garden's my favorite.
And those two books sold the fewest copies of anything I've written. So it tells you why I'm not writing more science fiction, more historicals. It's because, you know, publishers want a book that they know they can sell.
Can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming project, though, for those of us who like the history mystery?
Yeah. Combo? This is a book that was a surprise to me and to my publisher, because I'm contracted to do Rizzoli and Isles. Mm-hmm. But last year, I was in Venice for my birthday when I had a horrible nightmare. I think I probably drank too much that night. And I had a nightmare where I was playing my violin, and there was a baby sitting next to me. And as I played this music, the baby's eyes glowed red, and she turned into a monster. And I woke up and thought, oh my God, what was that all about? And as I walked around Venice, the story just kind of like swept over me. I knew exactly what was going to happen. It's about a woman violinist who picks up a handwritten music manuscript in Rome, but she doesn't know anything about it, takes it home, and every time she plays it, her three-year-old daughter goes berserk and does something horrible. She kills the cat. She stabs her mother. So the violinist she doesn't understand what's going on. She thinks the music is haunted. She wants to find out what it's all about. And there's a parallel story that goes into the history of the music, which was composed 70 years before this, and it goes back to the Holocaust in Italy. And what I was really fascinated by was how Italy was so different from the rest of these European countries that were dominated by the SS. Holland, Poland, Germany, their Jews all were slaughtered. They mm-hmm. were all sent to, you know, death camps. Yeah. But Italy saved 85% of its Jews.
Amazing.
And the question is why? What was different about Italy? Because they were part of the Axis. Right. They were ordered to turn over their Jews. They were supposed to be exterminated. But the Italians, as one Italian said, if we don't like a rule, we won't follow it. And what happened was, and there were these incidents, these wonderfully warm and human incidents where SS would order a police chief to round up all the Jews and take them to the train station for deportation. And what the police chief would do was he'd call up the Jews the night before and he'd say, "I'm coming to arrest you tomorrow." And of course, they'd all disappear. And the next morning, the Italian cop would go to the SS and go, "They vanished. I don't know what happened." And this would be repeated again and again. And neighbors would hide their neighbors. People would find sanctuary in convents and monasteries. The end result was that the SS did execute a number of Italians for hiding their neighbors. But it's just, you know, it just shows you how brave so many of them are. And it makes you think, well, you know, there's a reason not to follow rules sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
So the musical scores in the story are mm-hmm. written during the Italian Holocaust.
Yes. This one piece of music, which has a title of Incendio, which mm-hmm. means fire, is the one that she plays, and it's the one that this young Jewish composer composes. And I thought, as I was writing the book, I had another dream, and I woke up the next morning with the melody in my head. So I'm writing the composition now, and I think what we'll do is I'm going to have a friend from the Bangor Symphony perform it so that we can have music to go along with the story.
So that's so interesting. You're writing the story, you're writing the music. I love audiobooks, and this is a genre that translates so well, but that's one I'm particularly looking forward to because I can just imagine how the music will play into the audio version of the story.
I love this idea that how music has power over almost a century, mm-hmm. and that it can still affect today, people today, something that happened 70 years earlier. Yeah.
That's really a fascinating story about Italy as well. In Diagon, do you want to set up the story just basically for those of us who haven't read it without spoiling anything?
Well, okay, so you've heard the story about how it started, to mm-hmm. danger in the bush. It opens with seven tourists who fly in from around the world for the holiday of a lifetime. They booked their safari online, so they have never met the guy they're supposed to meet. There's a couple from Japan. There's a man from Boston. There are two beautiful blondes from Cape Town, I think, mm-hmm. and then there's the two featured characters who become really important to the story. One is Millie Jacobson, and she's a London bookseller, and she's there with her boyfriend, who's a thriller writer named Richard. Now, their relationship is going downhill. They've been together for 4 years. He hasn't asked her to marry him. She's desperate to keep the relationship going, so she agrees to go on the safari that she didn't really want to go on, mm-hmm. And they get to the bush. They're met by their guide, Johnny Possumus. They are driven into the wilderness, and they disappear. And 6 years later, there is a murder in Boston of a big game hunter who's found dressed, you know, hanged and dressed like his own game,
right.
in his residence. And Jane and Maura figure out there's a hunting theme going on here very quickly, and they follow the clues and realize it's all connected to what happened to those missing tourists in Botswana.
Millie is an interesting character because, her sections are the only part of the book that's written in first person.
Right.
And that was one of the things that we talked about in our book club, is why you chose to do that. And she seems like an unassuming character. Where did she come from?
Well, you know, I love characters who are, I always think of Bilbo Baggins and Frodo, the characters who are the least, you pay the least attention to, the sort of the ordinary people who find the inner strength to survive. Mm-hmm. I love, and Harry Potter's the same thing, the kid under the cupboard, right? And all of a sudden he becomes the most powerful wizard in the world. This journey from obscurity to heroism is fascinating to me, and that's what Millie is. She's really kind of a sad sack girl. I mean, here her boyfriend's about to dump her, and she doesn't want to be in the bush. She's very ordinary looking, and she's going to be having to call on her inner strength to see this through.
Did you intentionally write her portion in first person to hint at her importance?
I did.
Where did that come from?
You know, the first person to me is so personal. You can really get into mm-hmm. somebody's soul that way. You can really see their pain. You can mm-hmm. understand more about them. I don't use that by and large for the Jane and Maura sections, because I want to give you more of an overall look at what the mystery is doing. But for Maura, I mean, for Millie, it's very much a personal story about how she's falling apart, how her relationship is falling apart, and what she's going to do about it.
Yeah. You mentioned the opening scene where the Leonard is dressed and hung in his garage, and it is so gory. It's one of, I think, your more intensely, have a visceral reaction as you're reading it. Where the goriness, is this part of your medical training? Is it just part of your personality?
Well, it's anatomically correct, and that's what I try to be. I mean, if you cut somebody open, there's something in there.
Yeah.
I have actually broken down a deer.
Yeah.
And I helped my son gut chickens. So it's just like second nature to me, I guess. I think that if you're going to describe a crime scene, you have to describe it from the point of view of Maura Iles. And what does she see? You can't just say, body's there, knife is in the back, ho-hum,
right,
and skip the rest of it. You want to see what she sees because you want to enter her world.
Another interesting thing in the book was naming Millie.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that and tell us more about your work with Alzheimer's?
My dad died of Alzheimer's, and I think it's really a disgrace that we don't have more money devoted to research for Alzheimer's. So I had a fundraiser for Alzheimer's research. I invited my readers to give as little as $5 to $10 to the Scripps Institute in San Diego, which does a lot of biomedical research, and they specify Alzheimer's. And I said, we're going to have like a drawing, and whoever wins, every $5 you give, you get another entry. Whoever wins the drawing gets to name a character in my next book. So one man won. He only had to give, I think, $20, and he won. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want you to name it after my mother, who died of Alzheimer's, because I want to see her live again. And my mother's name was Millie Jacobson. So she's the one who really is this ordinary girl who comes, you know, really finds herself in the bush.
That's very, now will you do things like that in the future?
Yeah, I probably for the next Rosoli and Alice book, I Alzheimer's is really kind of something that I'm pretty passionate about, so I'll probably do it again. And I think it's really, for him, I think this young, the man who won, was very moved. He said, wow, it was great to see my mom have another life.
That's neat.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is interesting about your website is there's all the promotional information in the bio, but you have a blog, and your blog is very fascinating. It's a lot of fun to read. Is that something, just having that nonfiction outlet that...
Yeah, I used to blog more about the state of the industry, and then I kind of got tired of it because the industry keeps changing. What I used to have on my blog, and I haven't kept it up, is I had a section called Creepy Biological Facts because I have this filing cabinet of all these like weird little things that I found about biology. For instance, you know, the candiru little catfish down in the Amazon that is attracted to human urine. Mm. And so if you're bathing in there, it'll swim, it'll just follow that track right up your urethra. And because it's a catfish and it's needle thin, it has these spines so the spines open up and it lodges in there and you cannot get it out. And it's said to be one of the most painful things that you can imagine. And it's one of the few times where men are actually saying, cut it off, cut it off. So, I mean, I find things like this that kind of make you go, well, that's fun, or that's freaky, or wow, I would like to share that fact. So my sons are used to mom's freaky facts.
Yes. Did you share those freaky facts around the dinner table as well?
Those were the kinds of things that would make my younger son say, no more.
Would you share a little bit of Die Again with us?
I have a one-minute little segment. I've told you about my characters, Millie and her boyfriend Richard, and this is like the third day of the safari. They're out camping, and they've had a fight. And here's Millie talking. Outside our tent, the night is alive with sounds of the delta. We are camped not far from a river where earlier we saw hippos. I think I can hear them now, along with the croaks and cries and grunts of countless other creatures. But inside our tent, there is only silence. So this is where love comes to die, in a tent in the bush in Africa. If we were back in London, I'd be out of bed, dressed and off to my girlfriend's flat for brandy and sympathy. But here I'm trapped inside canvas, surrounded by things that want to eat me. Sheer claustrophobia makes me desperate to claw my way out of the tent to run screaming into the night. Richard has fallen asleep. How can he do that, just drop off so peacefully when I feel I'm about to shatter? I listen to him breathe in and out, so relaxed, so steady, the sound of him not caring. He's still deeply asleep when I awaken the next morning. As the light of dawn seeps through the seams of the tent, I think with dread of the day ahead. Another uneasy drive as we sit side by side, trying to be civil with each other. Another day of slapping mosquitoes and peeing in the bushes. Another evening of watching Richard flirt with the blondes and feeling another piece of my heart crumble away. This holiday cannot possibly get worse, I think. And then I hear the sound of a woman shrieking. Things are about to get worse.
It's interesting that you chose to read that section. One of the things that we agreed really in book club is that we loved your depiction of Africa. It was so vivid and beautiful, and you could tell you had been, even without reading the cover, the book jacket, that you had been there and that you weren't working off photographs. It was really
beautiful. I loved Africa. My only fear is that this is going to discourage people from going on safari, and I do not think anybody should be discouraged. I think everybody should go and see it at least once.
I also find it interesting that there's a pretty significant love story wrapped into this book, and that doesn't always happen.
There is. The question is, who do you trust?
Yeah.
Who should you fall in love with? And maybe you should listen to your heart sometimes.
We're going to take questions from
yes.
the audience this evening, so we'll turn it over. If you have a question for Tess, I'd ask that you raise your hand and right up here. Yep.
Can you talk about the evening that you spent with Don McLean?
That's funny because I got contacted by my publicist saying that Wall Street Journal has a section every weekend called Playlist, where they talk to people about their favorite song and why it was their favorite song. And I said I knew immediately what my favorite song was. It was Don McLean's song Vincent, otherwise known as Starry, Starry Night. And the reason it was my favorite was when I was in college, I had a boyfriend who did not appreciate me. I was like Millie with
yes.
Richard, right? And every time I'd hear that song, I felt like it was about me. Even though the song was about Vincent van Gogh, which is really unusual for a rock singer to write a song about Vincent van Gogh. But it was about his sadness and how he wasn't appreciated, and I felt that way. So it became my anthem for bad romance. And every time I'd hear it, I would always feel a little sad. So then I moved to Maine, and who lives in Maine, my town, but Don McLean? And his wife is a photographer, so she and my husband got to know each other, and we got to be friends, and we got invited, my husband and I were invited to Don McLean and his wife's house for dinner one night. And we're sitting at the dinner table, and I'm kind of like going, well, I'm sitting next to Don McLean. And I said, you know, your song, Vincent, is the best song that has ever been written. And he said, hold on. And he goes out, and he comes back with his guitar. And he sang it for me at the dinner table, just the four of us. And it was so beautiful. And I didn't tell him why the song was so significant to me, because my husband was sitting there. But now my husband has read the Wall Street Journal and he knows.
So does Don McLean, actually.
Yes, yes. I mean, if you haven't heard it for a while, go back and listen. It is the most literate song I can imagine, where he describes he describes all the images that Vincent van Gogh painted. I mean, I just can't imagine a singer today doing that.
Thank you again for coming, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun.
That was Tess Gerritsen talking with Carrie Woofter. Tess Gerritsen's latest book is Die Again. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For IPR, I'm Linnea Milcarrick.